The media landscape in America is busted. Americans are on to the omissions, the half-truths, and the outright lies being propagated against we, the people. Your host, Tom Harris, will bring you the other side of the story.
In today's episode, we are going to be speaking with one of the founders of the important climate and energy realist group, the Global Warming Policy Foundation. The work of the foundation is truly outstanding. If something appears on the Global Warming Policy Foundation website at thegwpf.org or in their hard copy literature, you can have absolute confidence that it's backed by solid research and clear thinking. So it's crucial that more people in North America hear about the foundation. I'm in the process of reading the report about ways in which science can better inform government. And I'll include a link to that report when it goes to the podcast on Monday, because it's an amazing report. Here's a quote to give people an idea about the foundation. Here's a quote from the foundation's website. "People are naturally concerned about the environment and want to see policies that enhance human well-being and protect the environment. Policies that don't hurt, but help. GWPF, which is Global Warming Policy Foundation, is committed to providing a platform for educational research and informed debates on these important issues. In order to make progress and advance effective policy assessments, it is essential to cultivate a culture of open debate and tolerance and learning." Open debate. Who would have thought that would be controversial in 2024? But today, most universities and colleges suppress debate on many of the most important issues of our time, climate change being one of them. To discuss this with me and my co-host Todd Royal, we're joined by Dr. Benny Peiser, who is a founder and currently director of the UK Global Warming Policy Foundation, which you can learn more about on the web, as I said, at thegwpf.org. Dr. Benny Peiser is a trained social anthropologist, and one of his interests in the field is, quote, "how climate change is portrayed as a potential disaster and how we respond to that." In 1997, Dr. Peiser established the Cambridge Conference Network, the world's leading climate policy network. He serves as co-editor of the journal Energy and Environment and is a regular contributor to Canada's National Post, and I read his articles there often, and I'm sure you do, Todd, too. He writes extensively about domestic and international climate policy. And here's an interesting side note, especially for me, since I'm an aerospace engineer. Benny has a strong interest in the risks posed by near-Earth objects, which are asteroids and comets whose orbits come within 30 million miles of Earth, and so have the potential to collide with our planet. Besides being a member of Space Guard UK, Benny has had a 10-kilometer asteroid, minor planet 7107, Peiser, named in his honor by the International Astronomical Union. Wow, that's pretty cool. So you're immortalized forever. Welcome to the show, Benny.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. It was nice to see you here in Ottawa. So over to you, Todd.
Benny, thanks for being on the show. I have read your work and your foundation's work for years. It's just top-notch work. But it's interesting to me because climate change obviously can be a bit of an unusual subject, particularly for a social anthropologist. I'm just interested to know, how did you become involved in the whole climate change movement, and how did you become interested in climate?
Well, as Tom pointed out, I started a science network, electronic network, really, on natural disasters about 25 years ago. And at the time, in the kind of mid-90s, we were mainly really focusing on large-scale natural disasters, in particular the new issue of the potential risk of near-Earth objects, asteroids, comets, at some point in the future colliding with Earth, and looking at what are the risks. Mm-hmm. And is there anything we can do about it? And I learned a lot about risk assessment, risk perception, how risk can be hyped up by the media, and what are the best ways of dealing with a potential low probability, high impact risk, such as the impact of an asteroid or a comet. And during those years, suddenly in the late 90s and early 21st century, climate change suddenly became a potential catastrophe. You know, it evolved from an issue that was regarded as, well, we are causing climate change, to, oh, it's the end of the world. You know, mm-hmm. we have 10 years to save the world. It's always 10 years.
Yeah.
It was already 10 years to save the world in the 90s. And so I thought, well, let's really have a look, you know, what is the risk? How serious is climate change as a potential disaster risk? And that's how, after many, many years looking at large scale disaster risks, such as volcanic eruptions and near-Earth objects hitting the Earth, I began to be interested in the risk of climate change.
Okay. Is that, can you tell me then, I'm just curious, how did the Global Warming Policy Foundation come about?
Well, as a result of my work with this Cambridge Conference Network, this network of scientists, astronomers, journalists, and interested people looking at these things, Lord Lawson, who was the former chancellor, finance minister under Margaret Thatcher, he wrote a bestseller on the whole climate issue,
okay,
and wanted to set up a think tank. And basically, he was part of that network and saw what I've been doing and eventually invited me and asked me to run his think tank. And we then launched the Global Warming Policy Foundation in 2009, just in the run-up to the Copenhagen Climate Summit.
Wow. Okay. So did you actually participate in the summit?
No, I've never been to any UN climate conference.
Oh, okay.
I always knew, you know, what would happen. And it's just kind of the normal winter retreat of the green blob, where they can meet
for 2 weeks. And yeah. I mean, to three of them, and mostly it's a waste of time, quite frankly.
It's although a waste I did go to time. It's a waste of money, and you know in advance how they will end.
Yeah, yeah. I went to the Copenhagen Climate Summit, and you know, Benny, it was funny because at the time, I mean, they've had bigger summits since then, but at the time, the Copenhagen Climate Summit was the largest conference in the history of the world. Jeez. And they're supposed to be preaching, you know, reducing energy use. It's crazy.
Yeah, it was, in a way, the Copenhagen Climate Summit was a turning point in the whole climate movement, in that for the first time, it became quite obvious that the West had lost the dominant position in the climate narrative, and the Chinese and the Indians, the Russians, and a couple of other countries took over. And remember, they actually met and agreed the conclusion and didn't allow any representative of the European Union in. So they may, and Obama had to gate crash their meeting just to get a foothold into the final agreement that the EU were excluded from.
Wow. And I suppose it's probably worse now, eh?
Well, it's just continued. Basically, it's a ritual. The ministers meet, the developing world, the OECD countries say we need to reduce emissions, and the developing world, including China and India and Russia, are saying, look, if you want us to decarbonize, we need about $3 trillion every year. If you, you know, here are our bank details.
Gosh.
Now, so stepping back to the Global Warming Policy Foundation, on your site, people see a lot of different projects. Can you tell us about some of them?
Oh, well, people should have a look at all the papers and reports. We publish a lot of papers, reports written mainly by experts in their own field. We also have an interesting way of reviewing the drafts of our papers. So before they get published, we actually publish the draft of a report or a paper and allow everyone and anyone to comment on the draft, because we've been in the past, we have a very kind of eminent list of academic advisors who peer review our publications. And you'll find all the kind of scientists and their names on our website. But we've decided, because people say, oh, this is not proper peer review. You know, these academics, they all think the same. So we've decided, look, if you have any criticism, if you find any flaws, any errors in what we want to publish, here's your opportunity to point out the flaws, and we will publish them. We publish the comments we receive on drafts. The authors then take all the comments into consideration, and eventually we'll publish the final version, which means we open our papers before we publish them and allow the public to comment and critique anything we publish.
Mm-hmm. So that's like super peer review, because all of your peers, including people who aren't, can comment.
Anyone, as long as it's a genuine, you know, comment and not abusive, we will accept that and publish that and allow any critic to critique anything we publish.
Wow. So you actually publish the critiques?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If you go on if you have a look, open peer review web page, you will find a number of our reports that were published, the drafts were published, and the comments are being published as well.
Mm, wow. Wow.
That's, that's fascinating. That really makes your reports as foolproof. I've never heard that done before. I mean, those are, that almost makes everything you're doing beyond above reproach. That's incredible. I did read, I've been a fan of the Manhattan Contrarian for quite a while. Francis Merton, read your report that he did on battery energy storage and his work. So I wanted to say thank you first for publishing him, and the work you guys have done on that have been top notch.
Well, Francis is the president of the American Friends of the GWPF. So we have a American arm, and Francis is the president of that American Friends of the GWPF.
Mm-hmm. I guess the group you're closest to in Canada would be Friends of Science, because you spoke there just recently, didn't you?
That's right. I gave a presentation to the Friends of Science, and I gave a presentation about 11 years ago, and warned the Canadians, don't, you know, follow the European route, because it will end in tears. Everyone will have very high energy bills. The, you know, industry will struggle with high energy prices, and people will struggle to heat their homes in the winter. And, you know, at the time, no one wanted to listen. But now, today, things have changed dramatically.
Yeah.
Europe faces a severe industrial crisis. And for the first time, policymakers, left, right, and center, are beginning to be worried about the damage and the costs of these unilateral policies. These are policies that are only being adopted in Western nations. Most countries around the world are not, they can't afford, and they are not as stupid adopt these kind of policies. So these are policies that only undermine mainly European and North American countries.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just wanted to point out one thing for our listening audience. Some people listening may say, oh, but China has to cap their emissions at 2030. They don't really, do they? Because Article 4 of the Framework Convention says that their first and overriding priority is poverty alleviation and development. And, you know, it's interesting, Benny, at the 2014 COP, they cornered the Chinese negotiator and they asked him, so would you renegotiate the Framework Convention? And he said, no, the purpose of the upcoming Paris Agreement is to enforce the framework, not to change it. So they must know they have a pretty good deal in this.
Oh, of course. They are, believe it or not, they are regarded legally, internationally, as a developing nation. So they are regarded like, you know, some poor African nation, and can essentially have a, you know, a free ride. And that's what they have, a free ride. And the irony is that they're building and producing all their green technology with the help of cheap coal-fired power plants, and yeah, are now selling those products very cheaply to Europe and the US, which is essentially killing European solar panel manufacturers, killing and will be killing European car makers as well, because the Chinese EVs are at least 30-40% cheaper. Mm-hmm. Many of them are actually better. So unless I read that there are some US senators wanting to ban Chinese EVs from being sold in the US, but unless you actually ban them or put huge tariffs on them, no one is going to buy a you know, expensive European EV if you can get it for half the price.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? I've been some great commentary I've read on how the United Kingdom is really something the West should be looking at, particularly the United States. It's a cautionary tale. Can you explain that a little bit, as the whole green energy, this, let's just say the last 10 to 25 years has taken off, and obviously as climate change and global warming, you know, it starts off as global warming, now it's climate change, now it's climate extinction. But you hear this cautionary tale. Your energy prices are higher, your electricity prices are higher. There's a deindustrialization that can go on in some ways. But yet when folks travel to London, you see nothing but a thriving city. It's beautiful. It's thriving. I'm supposed to travel there later on this year. Can you kind of speak with that? Because I think that's an interesting thing for people to understand, that you go to Heathrow, you go to London, it's incredible. It's beautiful. Everything seems amazing. But what's really going on in the country and even within the United Kingdom of Scotland and Wales?
Well, most of what you see in London, by the way, was built, you know, in the past. Britain is a stagnating economy. It's not really growing much, and is facing a real energy. And much of what has been done over the last 20 or 10, 20 years has been done on credit. So a lot of the money had to be borrowed. So we're heavily indebted. The economic prospects are not particularly good. Energy prices are about three times higher in Britain than they are in the US.
Wow.
Yeah, roughly.
Oof. Wait, can you say that again? And when you say energy prices, would you just really define that for the audience? Because we hear something like that, and that just made Tom go, whoa, and it makes me, it makes my mouth hang open and go,
okay,
wait a minute, did you just say three times higher?
Yeah. Well, look, if you need a lot of natural gas, which we do and you do, the gas price in the US is a fifth of what it is in Europe. So it's five times more expensive.
Oof.
To use natural gas.
Wow.
Which is obviously, well, which is basically, you've got shale gas, which has significantly reduced the cost of gas. Mm-hmm. In most European countries, shale gas is banned, or the extraction of shale gas is banned, although we're sitting here on a gold mine of shale gas in Britain, but we can't get it out of the ground. So that is one of the reasons why energy prices are extremely high. Also, remember that all the renewable energy that is being now used or generated is heavily subsidized. So we are spending roughly 10, 11 billion pounds per year on renewables, which go directly onto energy bills. And there are other costs involved with the whole net zero agenda. So energy prices are so high that most energy intensive industries have either moved away from, have exited Europe, or can only survive with huge multi-billion handouts by government. It's clear that any company that has to rely on energy, a lot of energy supply, energy-intensive countries, industries that have to pay two or three or four times more than their competitors, cannot compete with countries that have cheap energy. And that is what Europe currently is facing, is the Europe is the place with the highest energy cost in the world, having to compete with competitors who use much, you know, more competitive energy, have much more competitive energy costs. So there is the what you call deindustrialization is a direct result of uncompetitive energy costs, which have risen dramatically as a direct result of this agenda.
Mm-hmm. Would gasoline be a lot more expensive as well?
So that's petrol.
Yeah.
I think petrol prices are somewhat different, but not that much different, because obviously the petrol market is a global market. So the cost of petrol is not that different. But when it comes to natural gas, it makes a huge difference if you, because you don't have a global, you have a global LNG, or it's beginning to be a global LNG market, but gas hasn't been able to be transported as easily as oil. And so for you have more regional gas prices rather than a global, you know, gas price.
Mm-hmm. Do the people generally understand what's going on, or are they hidden from, is it hidden from them? Does the media cover it, or what's going on?
People are beginning to understand because they are being hit in their pockets. They are beginning to understand because it hurts. They're beginning to understand because they are struggling to heat their homes. At my presentation in Calgary, and I also met some, quite a number of MPs in Ottawa, I showed them the latest survey that was conducted in about a dozen or so European countries. And a huge survey with, you know, thousands of participants. And they were asked, people were asked two questions. They were saying, if you had to choose between energy bills, the cost of energy, and the climate targets, would you be in favor of the government strengthening climate targets, putting more effort into climate, even if that would mean that energy bills would increase? That was the first question. And the result was about a third would focus or prioritize climate over energy bills, and two thirds said, no, we wouldn't prioritize climate over energy bills.
Huh.
And the second question was, if the government could bring down the cost of energy, even if they would miss climate targets, would you be in favor of that? Sure. And again, about two thirds of the European public said they would prioritize bringing down energy costs, even if climate targets would be missed. What it means is that there has been a dramatic shift in public opinion in regard to their priorities. The climate issue has become a minority issue.
Mm.
And energy costs and the cost of living are the the absolutely dominating issue.
Mm.
This is reflected in almost every European country now reneging on their pledges or watering down their targets or delaying their policies. There's a huge concern that a growing number of voters will punish governments, will kick out governments, and will vote for skeptical parties. There are so-called populist parties who are skeptical of the whole green agenda. We have European elections in June. So there is a fear among many observers, mainstream parties, that they will get punished as a direct result of these extortionate prices and costs as a result of their policies.
What do you see? Because you basically answered my question. I was going to ask you about the electorate. What about within England and the United Kingdom? Do you see a voter backlash coming?
Yeah, of course. we have, you know, if you ask people, what do you prioritize, climate targets or your energy bills, it's quite obvious that the vast majority will always prioritize their well-being over long-term kind of issues about their, you know, impact. No one really knows what's going to happen in the next 50 or 100 years.
Yeah, we have to go for a quick break now, but when we get back, I'd like to ask Benny where he sees things going in the future for both Europe and North America. So we'll be right back after the break. Before we go to the break, I'd like to tell everybody about a new ready-to-eat metabolic health bar that I've started to make a regular part of my diet. It's called Heal Right, and it isn't just any old health food bar. It was developed after over 15 years of research by National Medal of Science recipient Dr. Bruce Ames and a team of scientists at University of California, San Francisco, Benioff Children's Hospital and Research Center at Oakland. Dr. Ames and his team developed Heal Right to address the epidemic of obesity and related diseases through micronutrition. They realized that the problems that many of us face with our health are not just due to consuming the wrong things, such as too much trans fats and sugar, but it's also due to the lack of sufficient micronutrients in our diet. In other words, the vitamins and minerals we need to be healthy. And that's the beauty of Heal Right food bars. Rather than having to consume countless vitamin and mineral pills and guessing at the correct dosages, these good-tasting bars give us over 20 essential micronutrients, antioxidants, fiber, proteins, and many other building blocks that promote high levels of health. To order Heal Right metabolic health bars, go to americaoutloud.shop and scroll down until you see the ad for Heal Right. Then click on the Heal Right ad and select Learn More to choose your order. I like caramel apple fig best. It's really wonderful. When you place your order, be sure to use the code OUTLOUD to receive 20% off, an exclusive benefit for the America Out Loud family of listeners and readers.
The buildup of spike proteins is dangerous to your health. Global Healing's Foreign Protein Cleanse detoxes your body, removing the spike proteins, allowing your body to repair from within. Formulated by Dr. Edward Group and by Dr. Brian Artis, Foreign Protein Cleanse targets and detoxes spike proteins in the body. Go to americaoutloud.shop and get 15% off using the code OUTLOUD. Global Healing, giving you the power to take control of your health naturally.
World-class care from doctors you can trust, all from the comfort of your home. That is One Wellness. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company launched the One Wellness membership to provide free monthly supplements and unlimited telemedicine access with doctors that share your values. Be a part of a revolutionary new healthcare system that puts your health and well-being above the interests of Big Pharma's bottom line. It's the way healthcare should be. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first month of One Wellness.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with Heal Right. Heal Right is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit healright.com/outloud or americaoutloud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX throat spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to americaoutloud.shop. That's americaoutloud.shop and use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Don't accept joint aches and stiffness as part of aging. Doctors at Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created joint health and mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexibility. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a gel you swallow. Get 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
Many voices, one freedom, united in the First Amendment. Our goal is to herald the voice of genuine liberty at AmericaOutloud.news, a place where you'll find the naked truth expressed with a patriotic heart. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
So we're back with Dr. Benny Pizer. He's head of the Global Warming Policy Foundation out of the UK, an amazing group. I really, really encourage people to check out, and we'll include a link to it as well as some of their reports when this goes to podcast on Monday. So Todd, over to you.
I to tell our audience, so I echo Tom, the work they're doing is really, you can make the argument that some of the best work going on the planet right now. Certainly in the West, it's clear, it's concise. They are so, I can't say enough about how good their reports are and how good the work is. Benny, I know you recently had taken, you know, a tour of Canada. How did it go? Where did you speak? And how did you feel it all went?
It was a very short tour. So I gave a presentation in Calgary to the Friends of Science, and I participated in a panel at the Canada Free and Strong, or Strong and Free Network conference in Ottawa the other day on the net zero rebellion in Europe. I had a lot of meetings and conversations with policymakers in Canada, with MPs and shadow ministers who are very, very concerned about developments in Europe and obviously concerned with developments in Canada themselves. And I just told them what the situation was in Europe and said, you're just 5 years behind Europe, but you face exactly the same problems. Industries will move to the US. Companies will shut down if they can no longer compete. And people's energy bills will go through the roof if you basically continue business as usual and don't realize that there are major problems with the whole agenda. And I also spoke to them about, you know, what are the alternatives, alternative pathways to a cleaner future. And of course, the big problem we face in Europe are basically the renewables, who are messing up the whole energy market in such a way that no one is building a power plant anymore without huge handouts, because renewables get prioritized, get priority into the national grid, and are destabilizing the whole energy system.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, we face a severe energy crisis, and not just an energy cost crisis, but also an energy security crisis. Renewables just don't deliver. There is simply no technology in sight that can actually stabilize renewables. All these kind of all the backups that you can imagine are basically conventional gas-fired power plants all over Europe. They are now building new gas-fired power plants because they realize that's the only thing that keeps lights on. Mm-hmm. And, so yeah, the meetings and the conference in Ottawa was very, very impressive. And of course, the Conservative Party in Canada seems to be upbeat. But I told them, look, if you get this wrong, you will end up like the Conservative Party in Britain, which is on its knees and is now below 20% and faces essential wipeout. So any government that punishes its voters by policies that makes their lives more miserable will be punished ultimately and will be kicked out. And a lot of governments in Europe face that prospect now.
Are they yet having blackouts across Europe and England? Because you remember in Texas back in 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they had massive blackout. Is that yet happening in Europe?
Well, we do have occasionally local blackouts. But as I said, because governments are throwing you know, hundreds of billions of euros and pounds at this issue, they can camouflage the problem by essentially paying conventional power generation to produce and generate electricity when renewables don't work. So there is still enough conventional power generation available for those periods, those, you know, Dunkelflaute periods when there is no wind and very little sun. But they obviously, you know, many countries want to close down conventional power generation, but they, I think they're beginning to realize that's impossible. That would then generate real blackouts if they were to go ahead with closing down conventional power plants.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've read is that when you use natural gas as a backup, not as baseload, that it's much less efficient. And as a consequence, you actually would be better off to just build a natural gas pipe or power plant and operate it at peak efficiency. So are they losing efficiency when they're up and down and up and down?
It's even worse. It's not only are they less efficient, but they are actually generating more CO2 emissions.
I've read that before too.
We published a paper showing that had we stuck Britain, which was, you know, official British policy in the 90s, a kind of gas to nuclear pathway, had we stuck to that, just gas to nuclear and totally ignored and abandoned renewables, we would have much cheaper energy and less CO2 emissions.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. Yeah, so I'll put a link to that report. I see a huge list of reports on the back of that document you gave me concerning science advising government. So is that report actually on your website right now?
All our reports are on our website.
Mm-hmm.
So you will find a number of reports on the energy policy crisis and also, incidentally, on alternative policy options for governments who are beginning to realize that prioritizing renewables is part of the problem and not part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
So we published, you know, we are not just saying, oh, this is all rubbish, this is all wrong, but we are actually thinking about what would be pragmatic alternatives to the current mess we're in.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jay Lair, who used to be my co-host on this show, sadly, he passed away about a year ago. He felt that to get this train turned around, people had to feel a great deal more pain. And you're not yet experiencing that pain in the UK and Europe, not to the extent he was saying, like massive blackouts. Do you think he's right? Do we have to have massive blackouts before people will wake up?
I don't think the blackouts is a big issue. I think they're totally overrated, primarily because governments will do a lot to avoid them and will throw billions at that to avoid blackouts. Mm-hmm. Blackouts are very short term and they are almost after a month or so forgotten. The real pain that people feel in their pockets is the cost of living and the cost of energy.
Yeah.
And that is actually changing people's minds on the net zero agenda. That is felt directly and is seen as a direct risk to the well-being of a family or a business. And that's the reason why we have a rebellion in Europe. You may have seen the Farmers' Rebellion, which actually was successful in that the European Commission abandoned its planned tariffs and targets and caved to the protest, but probably only in the run-up to the election. We'll have to wait and see what happens afterwards. But the protests are now so widespread that governments are beginning to actually respond, have to respond, out of fear of being kicked out by voters.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit more about the protests? Because in North America, our media generally are not covering that.
Well, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Well, we had a huge, huge wave of farmers protesting in Brussels, where the EU is based, and in European capitals, whether in France, in Germany, in Italy, in almost every single European country, huge farmers protests about climate targets for farmers. And as I said, as a result, about 2-3 weeks ago, the EU caved in to accommodate. The farmers said, okay, we will basically abandon our plans for these policies, for these targets, and stop protesting. Just stop, because we're facing an election. We don't want you on our side.
So is the implication that they'll actually go back to the targets once they're back after the election?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised.
That's a good question. Yeah.
Wouldn't be surprised. But it's not that easy to go back to policies that will be increasingly unpopular, and also a big problem for governments in annoying and alienating large sections, not just the public, but also of the economy and of businesses. So if you think about all these kind of pipe dreams that we were told would solve all these issues, right? Okay, we need backup for renewables, but we have hydrogen and we have CCS and we have batteries and so on, right? None of it is actually currently working or even technologically feasible at scale. So we are facing the real prospect of like someone jumping out of the high rise and saying, well, it's all going well. And that I think the reality is sinking in, that this whole experiment is going pear-shaped, is not going as planned. Probably my guess is probably the first major U-turn of the whole agenda will be on cars.
I can see
that. The European Union wanted to ban the sale of conventional cars by 2035. Britain wanted to ban the sale of conventional cars by 2030. Britain has delayed this now by 5 years. And the EU has essentially opened a loophole which allows car makers to continue producing internal combustion engines, because they say, well, you know, if you can drive a conventional car and use synthetic fuels, you're allowed to drive it. Right. So they opened this loophole, which means there won't be a ban on internal combustion. And who knows in 10 years' time what the situation is.
It will be.
I would not be surprised at all if that ban will be abandoned altogether. I would not be surprised that the whole experiment with EVs will be abandoned. And it will be like, oh, yeah, you want an EV, buy an EV. But if you don't want an EV, you don't have to.
Yeah.
I would not be surprised if that will go altogether.
Can I return again? You were talking about about backup generation for renewables. I'm in the nuclear power. I'm a nuclear power analyst currently, and I'm going to be going to a conference here. That's why I'm traveling. That's on nuclear power and the new generations of them. And what you hear now is nuclear power is going to be the perfect backup for renewables, that it can start and stop at will. And the new generation, what's referred to as generation 4 reactors or advanced reactors, which are the non-water cooled reactors, they can go up and down. It's just when you need it. Have you guys done any work on nuclear power? I'm sure you have, but have you done anything in this question, nuclear power backing up renewables?
We actually have commissioned a paper on a renewables dominated grid backed up by nuclear. And we think the major problem will be who's going to build nuclear power plants if they're only used for 15% of the year.
Yeah.
Or 20% of the year. So what you have in a renewables dominated national grid where, you know, 80% of the year you have enough renewables, where you don't need nuclear. You just have to switch it off altogether. And then only in periods where there isn't enough renewables, you are, oh, come on, give us some nuclear. Who's going to build a nuclear power plant that is not, you know, that doesn't actually generate very much electricity and only being used for backup, unless you basically have to subsidize that to the tune of billions of dollars or pounds. And of course, the nuclear industry is very happy with that. They say, well, what's the problem? We don't have to invest. We don't have to pay. The government wants nuclear to back up. So let them build the nuclear power plant. We'll just reap the reward. The more the merrier.
Do you know if technologically that reactor can ramp up and down the way they're talking about it at a moment's notice, or are they saying they're going to, because most of the time, at least conventional gigawatt scale reactors take a couple of days, sometimes more, to begin, as opposed to coal is the shortest time than natural gas. But a nuclear reactor cannot be turned on and off. Is your new commission study or findings, are they, what are y'all finding in that regard, the technology?
We haven't yet got the kind of draft. So that paper hasn't been published yet. My understanding is that theoretically it's possible, but practically it looks very dodgy, as I said, not just because of the technology, how fast you can ratchet up or ratchet down, 15 or 20% of the year where you don't have enough renewables. You essentially need almost an entire set of power plants that generate almost the entire energy needed a country needs. But the difference is that the second part, the duplicate part, is only used perhaps 20% or even less of the year and stands idle most of the year. It's totally uneconomic and has to be basically, can you imagine subsidizing an entire power system for 80% of the year just to stand idle? I mean, how this totally economic nonsense, but the industry doesn't care whether it's the nuclear or the gas industry. They say, well, we can solve your problem. You just have to pay us. That's simple.
In Canada, people are not yet ready to hear that none of this is necessary because there's no climate emergency. Do you find in the UK and Europe, people are more open to hearing that?
Well, I just mentioned the survey in European countries. They are not saying or asking, do you think there's a climate emergency? What they're saying is, if you would have to choose between bringing down the cost of energy and your energy bills and climate targets, what's your priority? And the vast majority, two-thirds of voters and of the public, clearly prioritize their well-being and the cost of their energy bills over. So indirectly, they're saying, we're not in a climate emergency because our main concern is that we're in an energy emergency.
Right. So the priorities. Yeah,
absolutely.
What my impression has always been, if you go in a pub, for instance, and you talk to ordinary people about these things, normally what happens if they don't like a policy like, this net zero policy, they'll find a good excuse for why they don't like the policy. So a lot of people who are really, really angry about energy costs are beginning to become skeptical about the climate scare because they can see that they are being scared into policies they are punished by. So there is a correlation between becoming skeptical about a policy and the kind of rationale for the policy.
Yeah, the Global Warming Policy Foundation has a number of reports on the science too, right? The lack of emergency.
Yes, well, you see, our main focus is on empirical data. We don't do any modeling, looking into the future, making predictions and so on. We just look at empirical data, observational data that is available for everyone, is in the public domain. And we look at, so what's going on in terms of global temperature and what's going on in terms of the impact of global warming, whether it's, extreme weather events or health or the economy. And we just use the available empirical data. And that tells you all you need to know about where we are on the climate issue. And it's clear that for the time being, there is no emergency, there's no crisis. And most parts of the world are coping very well by adapting to the, rise in global temperature. That doesn't mean that it will always be like this because no one knows what will be in 50 or 100 years. But what we also know is that the global warming trend, the trend of the rise in global temperatures, is much lower than predicted and most models predict. So we are essentially at the lowest possible end of the IPCC scenarios of warming, which means if warming were to continue, at the current rate, we would be able within the next 100 years to cope with the rising temperatures by adapting to it. If it continues at that rate and at that very low speed, but who, God knows what's going to happen in the next 100 years. No one knows.
Yeah, Christopher Monckton, Lord Monckton, he actually did a study and he found it was 50 times more expensive to try to stop climate change, if indeed you could, than if you just adapt to it. I mean, I guess you would agree with that conclusion.
Yeah, adaptation obviously is the rational policy. And in fact, you don't even need a policy because that's what people do automatically. If it's hot in your house, you try to cool it. If it's too cold in your house, you try to insulate it. So every household and every business and every country is doing adaptation almost automatically without even a policy forcing anyone into adapting, because it's in everyone's interest to adapt. Many countries and basically human societies have been adapting, you know, for thousands of years. That's why we are so successful as a species.
Exactly. You know, with your background in anthropology, do you actually look at other disasters through history, other disaster forecasts, whether they came true or not?
No, of course. And this is not the first time in human history that we, you know, face kind of collective hysteria and kind of apocalyptic doom mongering. This has been part of human societies for the last 5,000-6,000 years. Unfortunately, these periods are often periods of upheaval and violent protests and revolutions, because people are very afraid and are being scared to death. So there is a risk that the alarmism itself can backfire onto societies, not least because they are, you know, blind to the detrimental costs of rushed policies that are not very well balanced. In normal democracies, under normal circumstances, you have something called, you know, checks and balances. On the climate issue, there are no checks and there are no balances.
Yeah. Benny, why don't you think there are any checks or balances? Like, why has this gone from in the 70s global cooling to now global warming, and it's become just so unfettered? What do you see are the reasons or reason why?
Well, it is obviously a huge political and ideological weapon to generate fear and to force governments into certain actions and certain policy frameworks. And the, you know, it's a political weapon. And that only works if you silence any skeptics or critics who say, hold on, you know, that the emperor has no clothes. You're not allowed to say that, because people would say, all right, well, relax. No one is allowed to relax, because if you shout fire in the theater, and that's what basically the climate movement is, people will panic and will be afraid. And that has been working at least for 30 years or so. And only now there is a counter panic, almost outdoing the climate panic. And that is the panic of losing your standard of living, you know, losing your economy, losing your industry. That fear is now almost bigger than the fear of climate.
Yeah,
in a way, you can't reason someone out of a fear or panic that hasn't been reasoned in. But what is happening is you can counter panic people into having to weigh up which of the fear is, you know, is greater, the fear of change or the fear of losing your standard of living.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. You know, this discussion, and I'm going to share it everywhere, because we haven't had an anthropologist on before, and you've talked about a lot of the trends in society that I think people had better pay attention to. Our guest today has been Dr. Benny Pizer. He's actually the director of the UK-based Global Warming Policy Foundation, which you can learn about on the web at thegwpf.org. So thanks so much for being on our show. That was a very wonderful interview, especially considering you're probably still suffering jet lag, right?
Well, I've survived and I've recovered.
Oh, okay, that's great.
If people want to donate to your organization, where can they go?
For Americans, there is a website called the American Friends of the GWPF. It's a 501c3, so it's a kind of non-for-profit. And for Europeans, they can go on our website.
Yeah, right. Can Canadians donate too?
Yes, Canadians. We even have a friendly organization that is helping us and supporting us, which is called Energy Probe.
Okay.
So anyone wanting to support us can donate via Energy Probe, the Canadian Friends of the GWPF.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yes. Great. So I'll include a link to the Energy Probe and I'll get the actual link for the Canadian Friends of GWPF. Great. So unfortunately, we have to log out now. That was being a wonderful interview. Thanks so much, Benny. And I hope our listening audience will support the organization, Global Warming Policy Foundation, thegwpf.org. So this is Todd Royal, my co-host, and myself with our guest, Dr. Benny Pizer, signing out from the other side of the story. Before we end the program, I'd like to remind listeners to check out these Heal Right food bars. Okay, they contain over 20 essential micronutrients, antioxidants, fiber, protein, and many other building blocks that promote high levels of health. To order these Heal Right bars, go to americaoutloud.shop and scroll down until you see the ad for Heal Right. Then click on the Heal Right ad and select Learn More to choose your order. As I said earlier, I love caramel, apple, fig best. Well, anyway, when you place your order, be sure to use the code OUTLOUD to receive 20% off. That's an exclusive benefit for the America Out Loud family of listeners and readers.